Welcome back, Joe. How you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. This week we had a passing of another Juris Centenarian, Norman Lear. He passed away at age 101, reportedly. Before we get into that, I wanted to see, did you see some of the hearings? I think it was last Tuesday. The university presidents were called up on Capitol Hill and were lectured by the Congress critters about their anti-Semitism.
I watched them spellbound.
I think it was Harvard's Claudine Gay, Penn's Liz McGill, MIT President Sally Kornbluth testified before the U.S. House Education Work First Committee on Tuesday, defending their actions against what's called anti-Semitism, while citing the importance of safeguarding free speech. So, which matters more, the sensibilities or feelings of Jewish students, or free speech? But I think we found out what priority those in Congress have because they have responding to their paymasters or the people who hold them on a short leash because of blackmail. Committee Chair Virginia Fox, a North Carolina Republican who led the hearing, said she wanted to know why college administrators largely stood by allowing horrific rhetoric to fester and grow since the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. Now, what's happening is you have these protests that are occurring. We've talked about this before. The universities have long since become hotbeds of, political activism, particularly by youthful students. It's favored sort of leftist activism. Of course, there's identity politics with so-called racial minorities, people of color, sexual minorities, various degenerate identities. It used to be just be homosexual. Now it's any number of perversions I can't keep up with. As we've talked about, sort of what happened was at least like their golems have gotten out of control a little bit, and they think they have privilege, so they're protesting what they see to be sort of what they perceive as Israelis. Of course, it is occurring. They're bombing Palestinians, killing them by in the thousands. Of course, Israelis come across as being white. The Palestinians come across as being brown. So therefore, the Israelis are wrong based on their perception. But they're finding out that there's a hierarchy here. And so this type of protest is not really tolerated, at least not going to be tolerated for long. And there's a lot of political pressure to shut down what remains of free speech on these college campuses because it's stepping on Jewish toes. A survey released last week by the Anti-Defamation League, for take it as a grain of salt, 70% of Jewish college students have experienced witness anti-Semitism since the start of the school year. Now, anti-Semitism is being exposed to protest and criticism of Israel. Now what's presumed here, or at least what's implied in the statement, is that Israel now is linked with Jews, particularly American Jews. So American Jews are associated with the state of Israel. Well, I think correctly, but for the longest time we've told that there's a difference between Zionism and Judaism. American Jews aren't necessarily primarily loyal to Israel, but we're finding out there's obviously a lot of blurred lines here, let's just say. Criticism, basically, it's for Jews to suffer criticism on college campuses is considered anti-Semitism and wrong and should not be protected speech. But it certainly, what matters more, like Israelis bombing the Palestinians back to the Stone Age, killing tens of thousands, or hurt feelings on college campuses in the United States. We had this one exchange between Congressman Stefanik and I think the Harvard, well, one I caught was the one between Harvard President Gay, where she go proceed. See if you can identify the logic fail here. Stefanik declared that intifada and the word from a river to the sea is tantamount to genocide, or is by definition genocide. And therefore, if Harvard and other universities allow this type of rhetoric or these types of protests to persist or continue, Harvard is now endorsing genocide of Jews, the mass annihilation of Jews. So to oppose Israel as a state, or to oppose this constant expansion into Palestinian territories, Israel's continued occupation of these territories, is tantamount to advocating genocide. And the question was, does advocating genocide violate Harvard's rules of conduct? That was the question, I think verbatim. Now, do you see the logic fail there?
I mean, it's an absolute lump of incoherency, and it is a classic example of what I call the rule of diminishing returns, where they've got so many strands of propaganda in play, and they're all basically fundamentally irrational, of course, that they can't keep anything straight anymore. I mean, you know, the protests were, you know, pretty understandable because you had white people, or at least fair-skinned people, the Israelis, bombing children and hospitals and whatnot, of dark skin or swarthy people, right? The Palestinians, that's how it was characterized. So you'd think that it would be a pretty straightforward basis for protests. But then it turned out that the Israelis were not white people because they have a peculiar history, Holocaust and everything. And so they can't really be put into that category, nor can the Palestinians actually be people who can be persecuted or repressed because they have a peculiar history of anti-Semitism. And so none of these things, of course, can stand even the slightest scrutiny. But that is put aside because they bring out this expression from the rivers to the sea, which would seem like it's a clean slate of getting rid of Israel, even though the expression is really just characterizing the historical region of Palestine and meant to bring to mind the fact that, well, the Palestinians did have this as a homeland, and now they do not. And this should be seen as a basis to have some compassion for them. There's nothing in the statement calling for killing of Jews. It's just a declaration of the original historical region that the Palestinians lived in, which, of course, was guaranteed as something that they would have Arab political control over by the Hussein McMahon letters, which, you know, were supposed to govern the whole following World War I control over the region. So the idea that from the rivers to the sea was stolen from the Palestinians, from the Arabs, is absolutely correct. There's no way to get around the language in the letters. And if that wasn't bad enough, McMahon even went to the trouble of writing a letter in which he said, well, everything I've said to the Arabs to get them to fight against the Ottoman is a big lie, and we're never going to pay any attention to it as soon as we get them to side with us and get this concluded. So it's just as clear as a bell. No one can defy or interpret the language in any real way other than from the river to the sea was taken from the Palestinians. That's just a matter of fact. But getting back to the Harvard and the congressional hearings, they then define this in a way which creates the rationale for the argument of anti-Semitism, because they then define it as, well, we think it could mean, getting rid of Jews, killing Jews, right? That's how we defined this. And therefore, any presentation of this as a concept would then be, by our definitions, an attack against all Jews, genocide.
So Jewish privilege includes redefining Arabic words.
Redefining. So now, right. So now, with this complete, lack of any kind of coherent grammar, adherence to the rules of semantics, using the dictionary, using history, just forgetting all of that, we now get to this idea that there's a promotion of genocide. It's just ludicrous that this could be presented as an honest, presentation of what's occurring in these protests. But that's given then as the, this is what's really going on here. Now the university presidents need to step up and create language which uses the perverse definition of this experience, and then fall over one another trying to work as hard as they can to prevent this. The situation is surrealistic. It's surrealistic. It isn't, there's no tangible reality to any of the claims. The only thing that is really real that runs through the whole thing, Tim, is just the use of Jewish media, political, and financial power to intimidate people into basically lying about what's going on in their universities, and then saying that, yes, we admit or we will accept your criticism of us and we will try to do something about it, even though none of this is real. We will just do it because in this way, the reason, of course, they're doing this is to make sure that no one ever criticizes in any way the Jewish political power in the United States. I mean, this is the only real rationale for any of this kabuki theater that's going on. And then to digress and conclude, I would just say the thing that was really as vivid as the, you know, kind of the sort of show trial false confessions that were going on was just the bizarre reality of the morons that they put in as presidents of these universities. Yes. It was just embarrassing. These people as a collection, I mean, they couldn't, like 50 years ago, you know, been, you know, running, you know, like a school bus. I mean, it was just an embarrassment for the United States and for the universities. And of course it was it was infuriating for anyone who really cares about the First Amendment, because the First Amendment really should obviously protect any of the students who wanted to make a protest about the inappropriate, you know, kind of use of force by the Israelis, and wanted to support the idea of, well, maybe a little mercy for the Palestinians because they are human beings, even though they're dark skinned, mm-hmm. they still are humans. And anyway, it was, you know, it was a sickening spectacle. I hope that the response will be correct, which is this will continue to erode the basis, you know, of the intimidation, because it will just be so self-evidently incoherent. It's such obvious propaganda. People will start to, you know, actually question it. And I would just say finally, yeah, in the circles I run in, small as they are, this actually has happened. The Israeli response has really been seen as inappropriate, and the horror supposedly on the parts of the U.S. politicians over the anti-Semitism implicit in the protest has also been seen as inappropriate. So hopefully we're moving to a, you know, a more clear-minded world.
Yeah, you have a character like Claudine Gay, the president of Harvard, obviously an affirmative action DEI hire. And this is probably her being a Black female, you know, a BIPOC, probably the first time she's ever faced criticism. yeah. You know, because she's been privileged, installed, and of course she's facing criticism because now she's perceived as stepping on Jewish toes. So she's the hierarchy is being revealed to her. She's a golem. She serves that power first, and it is you'd have these, you know, mediocre people installed on these supposedly these prestigious universities. Amazing how many of them are women. I think none of the Jewish presidents were called up on Capitol Hill. but nevertheless, yeah, you want mediocre, you know, incompetent people, you know, shills, if you're just kind of tools ahead of these universities, because the oligarchs, particularly the Jewish oligarchs, who apparently dominate things, who donate a lot of money. I think as many as 1,600 Jewish donors are either have pulled, threatened to pull their donations to the universities because of the protest, because universities are functioning as universities are supposed to function, at least how they function in the past 60 years, meaning areas of protest. This is, I don't recall them, universities having any protests in the pre-war era, World War II. It's the post-war era, particularly the 1960s, that universities became these you know, hotbeds of protests. It speaks to the demographics and the politics of the era, but that's the youth culture, which of course the Jews were have played a big role in promoting. We can talk about that, our main topic, Norman Lear. But they don't want universities to educate. They don't want the mainstream media, the news media to inform, and they don't want government to represent the people. it's all being controlled, and any type of any signs of life, any vestigial, actions that give us a glimpse of what universities used to represent is pathologized and condemned as anti-Semitic because it isn't supporting a particular policy of a government of policy of a particular government in the Middle East. Apparently, it's the Jew it's the Israeli tail wagging the American dog here, and
Yeah, I mean, in an overall sense, it's actually very beneficial. I know it's just tragic.
It clarifies and illustrates the
It just
situation.
clarifies it so completely that the George Floyd protests were not really the representation of a political power, but were the rep it was a reputation of manipulation, right? You just clear as bell because they now the same groups wanting to protest and get some media support and maybe some funding in their support of the Palestinian genocide, they're given a slap in the face, told to shut up, and told that they're going to lose funding. So I guess that all of those corporations that gave the billions of dollars to Black Lives Matter, well, it turns out that that money comes with strings attached, guys.
Yes, Jewish philanthropy is Jewish control.
Yeah, exactly. And now it's just out in the open. I hope that people will realize, that they aren't going to a workers' paradise. They're not going to a place where they have political power. You see, this is what one hopes comes through to like the African American community and to like a white liberal individuals who are supporting this thing, that they'll see that, wait a second, this isn't going to some place where we have more political power. It's just the opposite. It's going to a place where we are in a completely controlled environment.
Well, that's the thing. They're just white liberals, if you will, or blacks, or homosexuals, or feminists. They have privilege by proxy because they're sort of the transitaries or janissaries for the Jewish oligarchy. If they, out of a sort of a liberal, if their liberal consciousness are being offended by the genocide or the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, currently being witnessed. They'll find out that all their privileges taken away, and the media will turn
Exactly.
against them. It's like
Exactly.
Harvard and University. I mean, it's a full court press by the media, and then no one on Capitol Hill and the media is speaking up for free speech, which you would think would matter more in the United States than the interest of the Israeli government and its policies in the Middle East, which by definition is controversial. The creation of the Israeli state was controversial. No, that's not a dispute because there are people who disputed it or were against it. Therefore, by definition, it was a controversial move in 1948. Therefore, its continued existence and policies to promote its continued existence and expansion are, by definition, controversial and therefore deserve a public airing in the media. Without this language of anti-Semitism, condemning language as if someone you are a priori morally inferior for questioning the policies of the Israeli state or the exercise of Jewish power in the West. It's ridiculous.
Well said. The whole point here is that really what we need is an objective and clear-minded discussion on historical realities and on the different special interests in this region and how best to like come to some conclusion about all of this. We need a clear-minded discussion.
Well, here's the problem is
Instead, what we get is propaganda. That's
if you have a discussion where languages retain their, or I'm sorry, where words retain their actual meaning and logic is employed and moral logic is employed, the Jews lose the argument.
Well, they certainly would in this case. There's no
Yes. Yeah, they
doubt
lose the argument. They lose the
about
argument. Yeah. If you have to,
it.
if
And,
your if
right.
your
And
argument consists of redefining words, truth is not on your side.
yeah, it's interesting this discussion because eventually we'll start talking about Norman Lear, and you can see the relationship between this issue and Norman Lear's stupid TV sitcoms. It's stupid in their kind of construction, but the
Stupid,
fact is
stupid, stupid, but
that
deadly.
In terms of their propaganda power, they were very deadly. And
Yes.
this is kind of the fact of our world, is that it is constructed through propaganda, not through reason. If you look at like the authoritarian personality and you listen, you read them talking about how they're going to use arrows, can see that. Well, okay, so that a homosexual or a transvestite might see this and go, well, this is fine. This is great. I mean, the, you know, use of sexuality, the broadening of it, the kind of ending of social restraint, all of this benefits me really well. But wait a second. It may benefit you well in the phase in which they're destroying heritage America, Christian culture. In that phase, it may well, you may get more.
Yes, you get what you immediately want, which isn't always good for you.
Well, but the thing is, if you when you get to saying, well, now look, here I am, a powerful politically, and you know, like a legitimate individual. Now I want more. I want real power. Now here you'll see the truth of the whole process.
Yes, if Drag Queen Story Hour came out against the Israelis and for the Palestinians,
then the drag queens would see
you would see the end of Drag Queen Story
Hour. So, this is really just the fundamental reality of our world, is that the people who are benefiting from the propaganda are in a dream world where they think they're getting actual political power. But the fact is, they are actually being used to destroy the one thing that could stand up against the Judeo-Masonic world domination. You see, at the end of the day, they end up more enslaved, more and more likely to be genocided, because they were fooled into thinking that they somehow had, they were part of the political power that was bringing about this new world. They weren't. They never were. Just like the poor BLM protesters and the deluded individuals on the campuses who were trying to find some way to get mercy for the Palestinian, you know, being genocided. Look, I'm sorry. Come to your senses. You know, realize that the process that made you, visible within the media is the same one that will slap you down and destroy you as soon as you have your usefulness has been used up. And if you ever protest against the power that has asserted you into the media, you will be destroyed immediately. That's why it's such a really good analogy that you gave concerning Drag Queen Story Hour. If they came out and said, you know, we really want to like make a, you know, an expansion of rights here, and we're going to mention that the Palestinians deserve more mercy than they're getting, that would be the end of it overnight. So there it is. That is the hierarchy of power, and it's an absolute one. It's binary. The Drag Queen Story Hour proponents may think this is great. We're getting to seduce children. But believe me, this is just a stopgap. It's a process that leads to their destruction at the end of it.
Well, this week we agreed to focus on the life and career of Norman Lear, a famed, very influential television producer of what called sitcoms, situation comedies. Of course, the most famous among those was All in the Family. It was sort of the flagship or anchor of his career. He apparently had wormed his way into the entertainment business in the 1950s with being a writer for the Danny Thomas Show, from what I understand. He kind of lied his way into that position. He produced a lot of shows in the early 60s. Of course, this was an era when TV was very vanilla, if you will, before it got topical and relevant. He spearheaded that in the early 70s. Of course, All in the Family, of course, Norman Lear was age 101. Born 1922, he was a World War II veteran, I believe, served in the Army Air Corps, so he participated in one degree or another in the savage Anglo-American bombing campaign against Germany during the Second World War. But All in the Family, of course, most people, it's kind of funny, I went to work, we had a meeting, and some of the younger guys in the office, I go, Norman Lear died, and they always gave me a blank stare. And you know who he was? No. Remember All in the Family? No. I says, well, no doubt he shaped the world living in today. You just don't know it. So it reverberates, his influence reverberates despite his demise and his, I guess you could say, his relative fall from fame this is just the fate of all celebrities. It's always ephemeral and short-lived, if you will. Nevertheless, All in the Family was his most famous show. I think it debuted in 1971. Again, was a situation comedy that aired on CBS television from 1971 to 1979. It had a number of spinoffs. Archie Bunker's Place, of course. There was, of course, the Jeffersons. Good Times come to mind. I think even the daughter character had her own show. Gloria. Maude, of course. Well, I think Maude was the first one, I think. Or was it the Jefferson?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Maude. Of course, Maude was the, I would say Maude and was the most political. The other shows were more, I guess you could say, were more subtle in their social messaging. But Maude and of course, All in the Family were the most political of his shows. The All in the Family was created by, of course, by Norman Lear and Alan David Budd Yorkin. It was inspired by a British TV show called Till Death Do Us Part, from what I understand. The show was set in Queens, New York. All in the Family followed the working class Archie Bunker, the Bunker family. It was played by the Irish Carol O'Connor, Irish-American Carol O'Connor. Archie Bunker, I think, was supposed to be an Episcopalian, although you could see that he was – because he just looked like a Catholic, Irish Catholic. But so I think a lot of I did an interview with James Tracy last summer about Norman Lear. He wrote an article, a very good article, which I highly recommend in Culture Wars magazine. And we just said maybe because he didn't want to make the character Catholic, because at the time, even as late as 1970s, Catholics were still too powerful and too well organized to openly confront. So it was easier to take on the Episcopalians. So they made him an Episcopalian. Archie Bunker was a blue-collar World War II veteran, an outspoken, if not befuddled, conservative, sort of overwhelmed by the changes overtaking his country at the time, and yelling at the TV set. And of course, he had a bumbling, kind-hearted wife, Edith Bunker, and of course, his daughter Gloria, played by Sally Struthers, had married a leftist, Michael Stivic, who either was Polish or Estonian. I think Archie Bunker referred to him as the Polak. Of course, he was played by a Jewish actor, Rob Reiner, who was, of course, the son of the famed comedian and TV producer, Carl Reiner. So nepotism, of course. Although I have to give Rob Reiner his due. He is talented, good producer. You know, but he is, of course, Jewish and very liberal. He did play the role well. I have to grant him that. Archie, of course, the show would have Archie Bunker frequently butting heads with Michael Stivic, his son-in-law, which Archie Bunker would call him Meathead. And the show, again, it was the first of its of the topical, irreverent sitcoms, you could say. This it took on a lot of the issues of the day, racial issues, ethnicity, sexuality, homosexuality, feminism, these things. They didn't call them LGBTQ rights at the time, but it these topics came up. Archie Bunker, again, was the sort of befuddled, overwhelmed conservative. He never won an argument. That's one thing you saw on the show. Although his character became more popular, this is an effect that perhaps wasn't intended by Norman Lear, because it appealed to most Americans at the time watching television. The idea was most Americans were watching television at the time, so the show was very influential. And Norman Lear, I think, objective with the TV shows, I think he admitted, was sort of making his values, his liberal Jewish values, normative throughout the country. He was part of a group called the Malibu Mafia, which was sort of a cabal of Jewish Hollywood producers who were trying to change American society, could make their values normative throughout the country through the use of entertainment. And we can talk about that in general. So, I mean, I'll let you take, I've been talking a lot, so I'll let you take it from there.
Well, the thing that's obvious is that TV was being used for propaganda.
What?
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? You know,
is that a violation of the FCC rules?
Of course, and it's actually a violation, at least in the spirit, if not the letter, of the First Amendment, because there's no response to any of the propaganda. Mm-hmm. Okay, so look at it in context. You know, you've got the issues that are going to be taken up by Lear and his sitcoms. You know, there's a gay insertion into our culture, there's integration, and there's also the assertion that white males are stupid and bigoted. Mm-hmm. Right, That's key to
Yeah, it pathologized ethnocentrism among ethnic whites, yes.
Right, of course. Now let's go backwards in time a little bit to see how this comes about. I mean, you know, they start incrementally with damaged goods where they insert, sexual topics, right? And they start becoming more and more common.
Sorry, damage, is that the 30s?
Earlier than that, I believe.
Really? 20. Okay. 20s, okay.
Yeah. And
that's a play?
Yeah, it's a play,
okay.
But it takes on explicitly sexual issues and which would have been or were even then considered potentially illegal, but they had the oligarchs supporting it. I mean,
that's a telling title to the damaged
right,
goods.
Of course, yeah. I mean, in the audience at the opening night, you had the Roosevelt family and the Rockefellers. So there
yeah.
you go. Anyway, so sexuality becomes, rather than something that's private and held within the family and religion, it becomes, part of the public domain. You then look at, the authoritarian personality, which is really kind of the basic outline of the Archie Bunker character. He is, his ethnocentrism is irrational and neurotic, comes from a bad place in the heart. He's a bigot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that has to be, addressed.
And, it's, and sorry, and his bigotry is born of his ignorance.
It's they're one and the same. And
yeah.
and now you also have Eros as going to be something they're going to use as propaganda to help us overcome our bigotry. And that's why, you get the sexuality that's being presented in these shows and Lear's shows, which are, kind of, they call them groundbreaking. But actually, they just go through, transvestitism, lesbianism, abortion, for example, is addressed here as a, with Maude actually
oh, yes. Yeah.
has an abortion. Now, all of these issues as cultural issues are presented in a propaganda form. In other words, in opposition to any of these changes to our culture, there's only bigotry. You have Archie Bunker and bigotry, and these issues are always presented as these are really wonderful people. They're the transvestite would be just someone that would just be so wonderful. I think the transvestite commits suicide because she's a victim of bigotry. Okay, so this is how they're presented. It's in the classic liberal vision, that there's bigotry and opposition to what is basically a workers' paradise, a sexual paradise that is just on the other side of the removal of the heritage Christian culture, right?
I mean, so basically, the problems stem from a lack of tolerance among the Christian majority.
Well, bigotry, an active kind of a bigotry and an ignorance. It's sort of like they're the. Now, so this is how.
Well, my point out is we hear the word tolerance a lot, and it's supposed to be a good thing. But in biological terms, tolerance is a bad thing because if you're intolerant, you're immediately alerted to the poison in your body, and you expel it. If you're too
right.
tolerant of it, you're like
well,
an alcoholic, and you die.
But that's a good analogy because the
and you
point
die is, a slow, agonizing death from it.
Well, yeah, and
so
that's excellent, Tim. That's a great analogy because the fact is that. What is never presented is just an open discussion where the pros and cons of these issues are given and reason is the direction that you're headed into. In other words, you don't talk about, well, if we open up sexuality, what will this do to the family? What will this do to, the individuals who are sexually fragile, and you suddenly have put these kinds of pornographic elements in front of them. You talk about the merging of the ethnicities. Well, what does that do in terms of the political power of the ethnicities? In other words, the honest discussion of the issues would have included the elements that are beneficial about the restrictions. You see, they could never do this. They could never, ever, ever bring an honest discussion to the American people because it would have precluded their desired goal. You could, in my opinion, if they would just bring out like, well, let's look at an honest kind of understanding of what would happen if we opened up our culture to the transvestite and promoted it. If they did that, what they would see is that, yes, individuals can be harmed by bigotry, perhaps, if it is applied against them. But society has consequences which can well be beneficial by the promotion of, well, for example, biological sexuality. By that, I mean the sexuality that can actually produce another generation.
Yes.
Right. So when you look at the woke political clump today, Tim, what you see is a biologically deranged entity. It cannot produce another generation. There's no way. You look at like the, first of all, like just throw out feminism, the lesbian, the homosexuals, the transvets, like, all of that is just gone. But then even those who are, you know, in the thrall of these ideas, what are their birth rates? They're nothing. They're zero. So it isn't a biologically healthy or even coherent entity, right? Now, if that idea had been presented by Archie Bunker, I think that show would have been not probably got high in the ratings, but sure would have been a lot more honest, you know, if it was wanting to have like a really beneficial aspect of on culture. Now, in terms of Lear, I'll just point out the guy is, you know, he's a Bohemian Grove individual, right? And a very powerful one. He actually gives lectures at the Bohemian Grove in secret, of course. Democracy doesn't get ever a chance to look at the real Norman Lear. I mean, that would perhaps expose, you know, what we all imagine him to be, those of us in the independent media. But nevertheless, so he's in the Bohemian Grove and he's putting out these propaganda so-called sitcoms, and no one ever is able, well, that's not true, but rarely do you have people take on the effects of the sitcom. Rarely do you have, you know, this could be incrementally moving to, well, the clump of the woke political class today, in which you have pornography, drug use, zero families, pornographic males, single moms, if there are any children being born. And it's just an absolute cesspool, which really is best represented by the street culture of the fentanyl brigade, to be yes. perfectly honest. So, okay, so that didn't work out too well, did it? Okay, well, let's now go back to Norman Lear as part, an incremental part of the process, and let's analyze him in that light. Let's look at, well, let's ask the question, was he really trying to simply destroy the Heritage America culture? Was there malevolence, you know, in what he was producing? Is all of this smiley-faced sitcom gags, you know, that are just all so delightful and everyone is just, you know, having such a great time as you move away from the historical culture. Could that have been a plot? Is this possible, Tim? So, you know, this is how I would like to, you know, remember Norman Lear, is by remembering we need to talk about the effect that he had incrementally, his sitcoms had, and also bring up the fact that, you know, we never had a chance to discuss this during the process itself. Maybe it's time we started to bring these concepts out and ask these questions now, you know, because for one thing, we can actually see the effects clearly at this point.
Yeah, very good. Very good points. One thing is with the effect of television, of course, I've mentioned this before. I'm reminded of the 1950s. Father Finney, he was a Catholic priest up in Massachusetts, who said that having a television in your room was having like having a rabbi in your living room. It wasn't a good idea. And he immediately saw the threat that television presented to America, to the public, and to Christian values, particularly Catholic values. Of course, I think he was defrocked for saying that, or by his cardinal. But the. Again, the inability to acknowledge the threat that people like Lear presented to the country because of their apparent, I guess you could say, how it came across as not being benign. Just these TV shows were just putting it out there. A lot of these shows although they he saw themselves as normalizing his values for the country, is what they're effectively doing was a Judaization of America through entertainment. What you had with these TV shows, All in the Family and Maude, as her husband would say, even other shows like One Day at a Time and these sitcoms, normalizing feminism, normalizing divorce, single motherhood, and these things, normalizing homosexuality, at least presenting it to it. They're always presented as I'm just putting it on. I'm portraying things on television, things that are naturally occurring, which wasn't really the case, because what he really was doing was changing society and trying to influence and push it in a certain direction. And of course, TV is a good way to do that, because most people look at television and they idealize television, meaning when you had families that are idolized in the 50s, like Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, these things, that was presenting an idealized version of American life. And it wasn't as corrosive. Directly corrosive. I would say just sitting in front of an electronic box and wasting hours watching is inherently problematic, but it wasn't inherently corrosive, because in the 60s you had very wholesome programming, although I'm not going to say it was completely bereft or void of propaganda. All of it is, because it's all about keeping your eyeballs on the screen, selling product and selling an idea. Same with the movies, but there was enough control at the time for those producing the products to genuflect to Christian sensibilities, decency at the time. That was smashed in the 1960s. But you had in the late 60s, you had what's called the rural purge of networking. When Beverly Hillbillies, Andy Griffith Show went off the air, and you had relevant television. That's what you had in topical shows in the 1970s, sitcoms. The whole idea was, but broadcasting itself in the country is supposed to have a public interest. Now, that's an interesting term. It's very general. To have understanding what public interest is, you have to have a consensus or understanding what good and bad is. Of course, in the post-war, that was confused, good and bad, intentionally. And so that idea was lost. But nevertheless, idea of open propaganda was frowned upon. Norman Lear was very defensive about that. He used to say that, well, I'm just putting it out there, you know, and this is just entertainment. It's not propaganda. It's debate, that sort of thing. But nevertheless, by the 1980s, he was very concerned. He formed a group called People for the American Way. And of course, the American Way was a Jewish way. And that was a response, large, I think, to Judge Bork nomination and the right wing, the 80s sort of a conservative counter-revolution to the 60s and 70s. And also to the efforts of televangelists and evangelical conservatives to use the television, like Pat Robertson and his network, Jerry Falwell, the Moral Majority, and he formed People for the American Way. And this is chutzpah irony, but he voiced concern the fact that these Christians were using television to promote their values. Well, wait a second. Wait a second. Hold on here. What were you doing in these shows? You know, you're promoting your values, you know, and so, but they didn't like it. But the one major handicap that these Christians had at the time was, although they were, you could say they were opposed to Norman Lear and his cultural agenda, feminism, abortion, liberalism, this sort of thing, because they promoted supposedly moral Christian ideas, anti-abortion, pro-family, was they were Zionist. Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell were Zionists. So they could never really confront the Jew directly on these matters. And this sort of blunted, they were,
I mean, I don't trust those individuals at all. And but I was just going to back up, because, you know, Father Charles Conklin, you know, was actually the beginning of Lear's.
That's right. He used to list him on the radio. He called him the Cossack on the radio.
He claims as a young man, he would listen to him and say to himself that this is anti-Semitism, because he's attacking a great hero such as Franklin Roosevelt. And he's also calling to mind the idea that perhaps Jewish bankers have too much political power. Mm-hmm. Right. This is what passes for, you know, inspirational kind of ideas for the young Norman Lear. And this is so the idea that, you know, his shows were not propaganda is ludicrous on its face, because he admits that he always intended them to be basically propaganda. Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, though, you have that, again, typical Jewish response to criticism is to see it as sort of anti-Semitic, deranged anti-Semitism and hatred,
right.
as opposed to proper.
They just define it in that way.
There's no introspection. So, well, maybe right. what we're doing is wrong.
And then, of course, bear in mind, I mean, one thing that I find just fascinating about Lear is that he was actually in the 463rd Bomb Group, mm-hmm. which is firebombing, right? Now, I don't know. I haven't able to find this, but he was in the group that did the firebombing. He talked openly about bombing Germany. And so I'm pretty sure that mm-hmm. he was like dropping incendiary bombs on civilian populations. Mm-hmm. I can't prove that, though, but I'm just saying the facts simply assert it, right, as this happened. Now, so this is the guy who's going to now criticize our culture as being, racially insensitive. A guy who could drop in, you know, without any problem whatsoever. And of course, this cast a wide net because everyone who was involved in this process, I think, is guilty of inhumanity. But he did have this capacity to like drop incendiary bombs, as far as I can tell, on top of civilians. Well, so what are his real he's someone who never opened up an honest discussion about anything ever. From the moment he listened to Father Conklin as a 10-year-old to his speeches at the Bohemian Grove, he's just an individual who gave in propaganda his entire life. Literally every single thing he ever did was just propaganda. And so
it was always ethnocentric.
Always ethnocentric, because yeah. frankly, I just don't see any propaganda anywhere that isn't at this point ethnocentric to Jewish interests, right? I mean, where is it? If there is some, show it to me. Mm-hmm. But certainly Lear and the Hollywood clique that worked so hard to change American culture were all propagandists, and they were all ethnocentric, focused on the Jewish self-interest. It's just self-evident. There's really no way you can get around that. So it's... Lear is someone who is praised as being, a person who opened up America to these new ideas. This is just ridiculous. He's someone who inserted intellectual structures in using propaganda to mentally dominate.
Didn't he just apply the authoritarian personality to television?
It's just the authoritarian personality come to life. The fact is that like Horkheimer and Adorno, they moved to Pacific Palisades mm-hmm. in the 50s and tried to get jobs in show business writing screenplays.
It was Columbia University and Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. they weren't any good at it, but Lear is just their descendant. I mean, this is literally the way to understand, All in the Family and Maude is just to read the final chapter of The Authoritarian Personality and go, oh, I see. Okay, this mm-hmm. is how they're implementing it. So we're the victim of propaganda, hopefully the independent media can make more of this, make it clearer and clearer to the public that, the great propaganda structures have to be exposed so that we can think clearly.
Yeah, there's I'll pull this from the James Tracy article that ran earlier this year in Culture Wars magazine. Norman Lear's television comedy introduced similarly provocative subject matters into the American living rooms so as to instruct the audience that yielding to the progress and change driven by the Jewish revolutionary spirit was the preferred path to social acceptance and success. Lear was a bold cultural subversive whose life work helped shape the political and cultural sensibilities of a nation, whose narrative has made once private affairs all too public while further inculcating the American polity, the acceptance of wanton sexuality, abortion, and disdain for traditional forms of Christianity so feared by St. John Chrysostom. Through All in the Family and its progeny, Lear's undeniably entertaining and successful work has contributed momentously to certain underlying assumptions and beliefs of the nation's present political consciousness. The major offense of the fictional Archie was, like my father and millions of other American men, simply confusion and discontent over the culture war of that era. The intent behind exhibiting that character's angst and callowness was to inculcate the public mind a specifically ethnic view of intolerance that could be mobilized to serve Jewish interest. Indeed, by way of Archie, the writer succeeded in making bigotry a household term while sneeringly affixing it with the very Christian religious identity that Jewish pressure groups had sought to target two decades earlier as they began their quest to restructure the attitudes of prejudiced individuals. I think it's a reference to authoritarian personality.
Yeah.
Like the Jewish-led Anti-Defamation League, that designates individuals and organizations whose views it deems objectionable as anti-Semitic and hateful, Lear's life works have been guided by identical ethnocentrically driven prejudice and from a religious perspective might be deemed amended guilt that he projected onto Father Coughlin during his childhood and anyone else, demonstrating a self-serving mix of politics and religions who dared challenge Jewish hegemony over thought and values thereafter. Through Archie and the dynamic exchange of his Judaized son-in-law, Lear successfully addressed concerns of the Jewish-dominated field of mass communication and public opinion research, specifically how to interpolate concerns over anti-Semitic prejudice and bigotry in the topical household consciousness and discourse. In so doing, the true focus, traditional Christian conservatism, was stigmatized and rendered undesirable. So,
really well said. And the kind of a clear concept that comes out of that is that the real bigot was Archie Bunkerstein. You know, in other words, Lear was the bigot here. There are probably some, I'm sure there are some Catholic individuals who would have bigotry that could come up, could approach what the character, you know, Archie Bunker was demonstrating. But I don't think there's anyone that is as self-centered, as ethnically centered, as racist, and as bigoted as Lear, yeah. Right? I mean, every single concept that he brings out is presented in the form that the Gentile culture is in opposition to this because of bigotry and irrationality. In other words, they're evil. And we can never permit them to even have a discussion about the issue. It must always be in the context of propaganda. And so Lear he's Archie Bunker, but he's in control of a huge cultural force with the sitcom. And the effect that this individual, Lear, is having and the reason for it are never discussed. No one ever has these discussions about him. Certainly never while he was, you know, this wrecking ball through American culture that he represented. Not once. That's not true. I actually did read a few mild criticisms of it, but nothing as articulate as the one that you just said, and nothing that actually got into the public domain as a real discussion. So, you know, it's ironic is all I can say that he would characterize basically Irish Catholic culture with his character Archie Bunker and all of his sitcoms as bigoted when he himself was the most bigoted individual that could even be imagined.
Well, that's Jewish privilege.
It is indeed.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, what Norman Lear, Hollywood, entertainment, media, the Jewish control of the media. This is a subset of, I think, funny how Jews of all, it's supposed to be a canard or a trope that Jews control the media, Jews control finance, or Jews don't know limits, but Jews actually have words for these things. So, I mean, they categorize and develop words to describe the very thing that's not supposed to exist. It's kind of funny why they do that. It's called hasbara, which is a Hebrew word for explanation. And basically, hasbara is the sort of the broad Jewish technique of public diplomacy. It's a technique that which links information warfare with sort of a strategic objective. And we see with the conflict in Israel or Palestine. Basically, it's to control the flow of information, control the narrative, if you will. And of course, entertainment's a big part of this because most people get their perception of reality through the television or movies. Particularly in the age of electronic media. This is a particular problem with the development of mass media and electronic media. It's a system that really didn't no one had the capacity to do this until the 20th century, and this was a challenge. And of course, the development of mass media, Hollywood, radio, television also coincided with the mass migration and also the meteoric rise of at least certain Jews in American society. And of course, American society itself was, there was, it was definitely Christian culturally. Legally, it was very liberal and open, and therefore exposed to manipulation and subversion, because technically speaking, we have the First Amendment, freedom of speech, non-establishment clause, and these things. So you, if you have a very, I guess, in-group, a very nepotistic and ethnocentric group with a sense of historical sense of grievance, they can very easily take over, and evidently they have and did. In the 20th century, which we call the 20th century, Yuri Slezkind wrote a book called The Jewish Century, the 20th century being the Jewish century. Modernity is Jewish, and Jews are modernity. And many people, and again, as we saw with Norman Lear, effectively using television in its heyday, the sitcom, this is when there were literally three networks. And so they could control a lot. I mean, a lot of eyeballs on this stuff. And the explosion of television ownership from 1950 to 90, literally went from 2% of homes in 1950 to 90% of homes in 1960. And you can see suburbia, these box homes with television antennas, you know, the same way that cable became very influential in the 90s and the aughts, and media changes, of course, and we see that. We can, but nevertheless, this has bare the challenge that electronic media presented to America and to the world, actually, and the responsibility of those who control that. And there was some recognition of that in the 1920s when laws were passed, like the Radio Control Act and the Federal Communications Act, making sure that these networks pursue public interest. Again, as I said earlier, this presumes a consensus of what public interest is. But in the Cultural Revolution, subversion of the 1950s and 60s, and the introduction of moral confusion into society through entertainment, this became jumbled. The idea that you can't even identify what American interests are anymore. What's America? These things, the values. They've confused all these things because that's all part of the authoritarian personality, the assault on sort of the Christian consensus. America in 1900 was a broadly Protestant country. By the year 2000, it had been Judaized, largely through electronic media. There's some recognition of this challenge that electronic media poses to society, particularly in a liberal society, when there isn't one authority to determine what decency is. And again, we used to have these laws. Those laws were subverted gradually over litigation, largely because of Jews, in the 1940s and 50s, with the normalization, well, first the legalization, then the normalization of pornography. They sort of confused pornography covering with the First Amendment. At the same time, as they gained more controls, suppressing free speech, calling it hate speech. So they've, you know, they twisted that. But in the this challenge of electronic media posed to the value, again, this is what Norman Lear sort of represented, was the abuse of that privilege or power. The Catholic Church, one of the less publicized but more interesting documents that came out of Vatican II was Inter Mirifico, which I think it means among the wonderful in Latin. It was subtitled Decree on Media and Social Communication. And it was about the responsibility that those had who control electronic media and promoting the moral order, promoting the good. Again, this presumes a consensus, a Christian consensus on what decency is. But the problem is if your system is liberal and open to subversion, if you will, particularly by Jews, because by virtue of its liberal principles, you can't exclude them, of course, and these Jews are dedicated to promoting their values, which are anti-Christian, you have a problem here. And so why the document talks about promoting social, using the means of social communication, electronic media, to promote the good, to exalt, to improve society. And you can use media for these purposes. I'm thinking in the 1950s, I think it was you had a bishop, you had a Catholic bishop beating out Minton Burl in the ratings, and his show consisted of him writing about philosophy on a chalkboard. And it all depends on what you present, right? And you can actually entice, and you can actually improve the public's knowledge. You know, you can exalt
that's actually
improve them.
Possible. Yeah,
not degrade them, not dumb everything down. It all depends on what you choose to do. And this document acknowledged that you had a moral responsibility to do this. But if you're inviting characters in like Norman Lear, who almost are subversive by nature, based on their, you know, their the legacy of their people, you're not going to get that. At the same time, the Catholic Church produces this document inter amorifica, meaning that those who control the means of social communication, electronic media, have a moral responsibility to promote the good, not promote the arts or promote liberalism, promote, you know, stimulate the thought, to promote the good. The Catholic Church also produces Nostra Aetate, which focuses on the Catholic Church's relationship to other religions, particularly the Jews. And that document condemns anti-Semitism in all its forms without defining anti-Semitism, which is the problem. Because as you all know, as you go back to where we opened this discussion, the definition of anti-Semitism is now just simply criticism of Jews and how they exercise their power, which is great in our liberal society. So at the same time the Catholic Church is producing this document inter amorifica, it's undermining itself and challenging those who are abusing the media the most, which is organized Jewry. Because if you can't criticize Jewish power, you won't be able to criticize the media, because Jews control the media, which isn't controversial, by the way. They brag about it. We don't have time to get, we can maybe talk with another discussion about the fact of Jewish control of the media. Thing is, if your definition of anti-Semitism is so broad as to include any criticism of Jews, then you won't be able to criticize the established media for violating the principles or laid down inter amorifica, because they're using the electronic media to downgrade, to corrupt and change American society. See my point?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a clear one and correct. I would say that there was a complete failure from the various elements within European culture to defend itself from basically like 1880 to the present moment. I mean, yeah. Every single thing that should have been defending and trying to promote it has failed to some extent. And so you end up with the fentanyl brigade, the woke, mm-hmm. you know, kind of basically the victims of this process. But I would just note there's a silver lining at the moment in that a bifurcation is now possible because, well, for one thing, the physical regions that, you know, these groups inhabit has become impossible to live in to some extent. And so there's an exodus now from, like, you know, places like San Francisco and Portland and this, mm-hmm. and they're moving out to the suburbs, to these small towns. And they're moving out with the awareness of, or at least hopefully, of like what the effects of the Great Society programs, of the transvestite movement. They can see that these things may have had, you know, kind of a moral dimension when the ideas were presented. But in fact, the results are catastrophic. You can really see with the fentanyl brigade and the collapse of these cities and these zones where the Soros DA and all of these, you know, destructive political elements are now just like a vortex sucking these things into the abyss. So there's a bifurcation occurring. And this time when the heritage Americans move out to the suburbs, this time they can bring hopefully a little more wisdom. And they're also bringing the independent media, which they didn't have as there was no defense whatsoever. Because as you point out, like in 1950 and 60, you had three networks, all of them were controlled. And so the propaganda was just not only nonstop, but it was not contested whatsoever. But now there is an actual opportunity. And I think we should focus on that, you know, you're having like in California, a dramatic rise in homeschooling. Mm-hmm. There's been a dramatic reduction of uptakes of vaccines, all kinds, because there is now skepticism that is coming into place. And let's hope that we're really at the dawning of a new era of skepticism, which will protect us against the propaganda, the authoritarian personality, all of the tropes that we've been subjected to over the last, you know, 150 years, that we'll have an awareness and a skepticism that will protect us as we move away from the zones which are controlled by the fentanyl brigades. So, you know, yes, it's been a tremendous destruction. I mean, look at the chemical destruction of, you know, the European over the last 100 years. You know, look at the reduction in sperm count, the reduction in testosterone, you know, so the rise in autism. All of these things are part of the attack on us. When we move out now, and hopefully we can reestablish ourselves to some extent, you know, in these little towns which were largely abandoned, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, move back, in small groups and bring our wisdom with us and then try to recreate some political power in these areas, because there's no other way to live at this point. The effects of all of the propaganda, the kind that Lear was, you know, hoisting upon us, have now become clear. It wasn't taking us to a workers' paradise, was it? There is no area that is under the political control of this philosophy that is habitable. It's all gone. It's all exposed now. This is what they really had in mind. They had this clump of deracinated, desexualized, detestosterized. I mean, it's just, you can drive down the roads now and look at their product. The people are just passed out on the streets. They're living in tents in their feces. There it is. So this is what they have as their product. We can now take this wisdom and say, you know, let's try something else. Let's try a little bit of skepticism. Let's be a little bit more open to alternative explanations of reality than the ones given to us by people like Norman Lear.
Now, before we close out the conversation, I did hear late, and I don't know if this is true or not, but E. Michael Jones sent out this tweet. The Jew Norman Lear, producer of All in the Family, converted to Catholicism, age 100 in 2022. God has a plan for the Jews, and it involves baptism, as Peter pointed out in the Acts of the Apostles. I've tried to do a look in, and there is some discussion of him converting. I don't know. I mean, I'm not into maledictions, so I'm not going to, you know, pray for his suffering in eternal life, in his eternal life. I'm a little skeptical, I have to admit, but there is some word. Apparently his daughter did convert to Catholicism at all places, Harvard. She was a student there, I guess. And so perhaps there was some late, you know, no one called it a deathbed conversion, it was a year before his death. But there is perhaps, I mean, just throwing it out there. You can't discount these things, of course. God created the universe, so he could bring about Norman Lear's conversion.
Well, let me
here's the thing. Perhaps Mr. Lear was gently moved at the ripe old age, 100 years old, to convert, witnessing sort of the recent madness of the world in recent years. And so he began to question his own beliefs, and maybe he was moved to converting. Either way,
like cover his tracks and to, you know.
Yeah, but the problem is a conversion strategy, age 100, doesn't work.
Right. Let me just give you a little historical anecdote that might illuminate this. Talleyrand, Napoleon's general. Now Talleyrand was a Catholic bishop that, when the French Revolution occurred, converted to the revolution because
he'd always switched sides. Yes,
he was threatening. He was threatened with the guillotine. So then he became Napoleon's chief spy, mm-hmm. and had all of these ways of seducing individuals with just every imaginable technique. Kind of mm-hmm. like a modern or a historical Epstein, right? I mean, this is his role for Napoleon. Then he got sick, and on his deathbed, he reconverted to Catholicism and died. And the next day, the headlines read, Talleyrand cheated everyone, even the devil. So in terms of Lear, I don't know.
It's hard to believe, but then again, it is hard to believe. I guess you could say sometimes.
I just wanted to mention two things before you leave. David Schmidt, the indefatigable biologist, is really getting some interesting things done with Derek Chauvin, and I would just recommend anyone who's kind of wanting to revisit that whole, you know, like, did Chauvin actually kill George mm-hmm. Floyd? Look at the stuff that he's coming up with in his Substack. Really interesting, good science. And then also, I wanted to praise you for your interview with Gemma.
Oh, thank you.
Just extraordinary. I mean, the idea that the whole thing, the whole murdering of the Irish children and the riots, was all an orchestration, right? I couldn't even imagine that. But her explanation of it just seemed, you know, very clear-minded. And I just recommend anyone who hasn't listened to the interview to do so.
Yeah, these events either can be nudged or forced and then exploited, and what level they're being faked. That's the
Yeah,
question.
and anyone who doesn't get your Substack is just not an informed person, because that's where the information breaks. You know what I mean? You get all the interviews out so quickly, and oh wow, it's a privilege, Tim, to be able to read them. I think everyone should support you in that area.
Oh, thanks. Yeah,
every
the
way.
Yeah, I think Talleyrand is the one who said that treason is always a question of timing.
That's right. Well, you know, I've actually been to his chateau, and it's just a maze of secret panels and spy holes. I mean, it's just incredible, you know, that he developed this whole spy world of like trying to, find ways to compromise diplomats from other countries so that then he could use, you know, the fact that they'd slept with some underage girl to get information he could then pass
Well,
on.
Some things never change, do they?
No, it seemed really modern, you know, when I was there.
So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Well, good luck, brother. We'll get them next week.